So, a really quick introduction to Christina Podevseva, who I think is known to all of you here. Christina is editor of Philip, an artist, editor of Philip, and visiting scholar at CCA in San Francisco. And this is the second of the Or Gallery Beach Talks. Later this month, or later upcoming, we expect talks by Michael Turner, and we're also hoping to organize one with Laura Piasta. So, stay tuned for that, and thanks for all for coming.
So this morning when I was waking up, I was recalling a dream that I had. Either it was this morning or last night, and it was kind of strange because it was a weather dream, and I find that was extraordinary for a couple of reasons. The first being that, you know, I don't really dream about the weather, but the second being that the weather that was in it was really extreme and terrifying. And what happened was, I saw at least 10 tornadoes twisting through a landscape on the horizon, and as it was going, as they were going through, rooftops and treetops were being thrown up. It was pretty dramatic, and it was happening in that slow-mo pace, you know, that happens when you witness a disaster. For some reason, it always happens in slow motion, and so in the dream, it happened for me in slow motion as well. And so, even though the twisters seemed to be moving in this slow pace, they weren't really incidental. In fact, they were, you know, lifting houses off their foundations or leaving people behind who were homeless or dead. So it was pretty scary and dramatic. So when I got up, I decided to look up online, like, how you measure tornadoes, because I wasn't really familiar with that. And of course, with hurricanes, we kind of know a little bit more about them, but with tornadoes, it's a little different. So apparently, tornadoes are evaluated on the F scale, an F0 being light damage, such as you would experience if you saw a chipped chimney or tree branches that were broken. Something that you might sort of respond to by saying, oh, fuck, you know. F5, however, is the kind that I dreamt about, which is the kind where you run for cover. And I think, of course, in that one, you would utter that word many, many more times. So when I was reflecting on the dream this morning, I was also thinking that, you know, this is my subconscious giving me a metaphor about now. You know, yesterday, as many of you know, the Pussy Riot verdict and the jailing previous to that was given a lot of attention. There have been recent massacres, of course, in South Africa where strikers were massacred. The glaciers and the icebergs seem to be disappearing, and of course Syria seems to be an ongoing hell on earth. So I know, of course, this has a lot to do with media manipulations, and maybe not fully reality, but it's hard not to feel like we're going under socially, politically, environmentally, economically, etc. But we're certainly not the first people to go through this, and we won't be the last. So I guess what this talk is really about for me is an attempt to commune with an artist from the past who has talked about these times, if you will, and work through a similar problem, which is, what is the role of the artist in such times? What is the role of the artist in society? Okay, so this talk is much more about being exploratory and is collaged together than is structured or rigorous. So I apologize if this is what you're expecting, but since we're on the beach, I think it's apropos. Okay, so why Melville here and now? Well, you know, obviously there's an association to the sea, which is the first link. But I think equally we can draw from his expertise as an artist of enormous talent and insight. Moby Dick being the masterpiece case in point. For me, actually, Corey, it's a complete work of art. If such a thing is possible, because it challenges and delights me not only in form and experiment, but in conscience and depth. And I think that's a rare thing. So, okay, we don't have time, obviously, to read Moby Dick together on the beach. But I did recently and luckily stumble upon a nice short story by Melville, which was written a few years before he died in 1891. So the story itself was published in 1888, and it was an edition of 25 copies. So that means he really published it for friends and family. It wasn't for any kind of major release. Okay, so to set this up, perhaps what I should say first is that by that time, by the 1880s, he was working in relative obscurity. He had enjoyed a lot of success in the 1840s, but later on, as he kept writing, he wasn't given as much critical acclaim. And even other artists were not as interested in him. What else should I say? So I think in this story, the protagonist is John Marr, and I think he's a stand-in for Melville himself, also a former mariner. But for Melville, as a living artist at the end of his life, he was a writer weighing the experience of his own life and work and context. Equally, I think this story is a testament to change, to the convulsive force of industrial capitalism on society and culture in fin de siècle America. And I guess without further ado, we'll start reading it together. And I know it's hard to read Melville aloud sometimes because it's this 19th century Melville-ese. So it's okay if we stumble, I think, through it, but I think it's fun to read it out loud and to hear how everyone articulates it. So I'll start off with the first paragraph, and then maybe we'll move to you. Does that sound good?
Okay.
And we'll just go around. Okay. And if you want copies, we have some more right back there. John Marr, toward the close of the last century, born in America of a mother unknown, and from boyhood up to maturity a sailor under diverse flags, disabled at last from further maritime life by a crippling wound, received at close quarters with pirates of the Keys, eventually betakes himself for a livelihood to less active employment ashore. There, too, he transfers his rambling disposition acquired as a seafarer.
After a variety of removals...
Can you do a little louder? Sorry.
I'll try, yeah. After a variety of removals, I first as a sailmaker from seaport to seaport, then adventurously inland as rough bench carpenter, he, finally, in the last named capacity, settles down about the year 1838 upon what was then a frontier prairie, sparsely sprinkled with small oak groves and yet fewer log houses of a little colony. But recently from one of our elder inland states. Here, putting a period to his rovings, he marries.
Ere long a fever, the bane of new settlements on teeming loam, and whose sallow livery was certain to show itself after an interval in the complexions of too many of these people, carries off his young wife and infant child. In one coffin, put together by his own hands, they are committed with meager rites to the earth. Another mound, though a small one, in the wide prairie, nor far from where the mound builders of a race only conjecturable had left their pottery and bones, one common clay, under a strange terrace serpentine in form.
With an honest stillness in his general mien, swarthy and black-browed, with eyes that could soften or flash, but never harden, yet disclosing at times a melancholy depth, this kinless man had affections which, once placed, not readily could be dislodged or resigned to a substitute object. Being now arrived at middle life, he resolves never to quit the soil that holds the only beings ever connected with him by love in the family tie. His log house he lets to a newcomer, one glad enough to get it, and dwells with the household.
While the acuter sense of his bereavement becomes mollified by time, the void at heart abides. Fain, if possible, would he fill that void by cultivating social relations yet nearer than before with a people whose lot he purposes sharing to the end. Relations superadded to that mere workaday bond arising from participation in the same outward hardship, making reciprocal helpfulness a matter of course. But here, and nobody to blame, he is obstructed.
More familiarity. More familiarity to consort, men of a practical turn must sympathetically converse and upon topics of real life. But whenever as to persons or events, one cannot always be talking about the present, much less speculating about the future. One must needs recur to the past, which, with the mass of men, where the past is in any personal way a common inheritance, supplies to most practical natures the basis of sympathetic communion.
But the past of John Marr was not the past of these pioneers. Their hands had rested on the plowtail, his upon the ship's helm. They knew that their own kind and their own
habituation to monotonous hardship, aesthetics, I can't see, that's the problem. By necessity not less than through moral bias. Nearly all of them sincerely, however, narrowly religious. They were kindly at need after their fashion, but to a man wanted, as John Marr in his previous homeless sojournings could not have been. To the free and easy tavern clubs affording cheap recreation of an evening in certain old and comfortable seaport towns of that time, and yet more familiar with the companionship afloat of the sailors of the same period. Something was lacking. That something was geniality, the flower of life springing from some sense of joy in it, more or less. This their lot could not give to these hard-working endurers of dispirited malaria, men to whom a holiday never came, and they had too much of uprightness and no art at all, or desire to affect what they really did not feel. At a corn husking, their last grave of gathering, did the lone-hearted mariner seek to divert his own thoughts from sadness and in some degree interest in theirs by averting to aught removed from crosses and trials of their personal surroundings. Naturally enough, he would slide into some marine story or picture, but would soon recoil upon himself and be silent, finding no encouragement to proceed. Upon one such occasion, an elderly man, a blacksmith, and at Sunday gathering, an earnest exhorter, honestly said to him, "Friend, we know nothing of that here."
Such unresponsiveness is in one's fellow creatures, set apart from the factitious life, and by their vocation, in those days a little helped by machinery, standing, as it were, next of kin to nature. This to John Marr seemed of a piece with the apathy of nature herself, as envisaged to him here on a prairie, where none but the perished mound builders had as yet left a durable mark.
Where am I?
The rim.
The
rim.
Top of 16.
16, okay. The remnant of Indians thereabout, but all exterminated in their recent and final war with regular white troops, a war waged by the red man for their native soil and natural rights, had been coerced into the occupancy of wilds not very far beyond the Mississippi. Wilds then, but now the seats of municipalities and states. Prior to that, the bisons once streaming countless in processional herds, or browsing as in an endless battle line over these vast aboriginal pastures, had retreated, dwindled in number, before the hunters in Maine, a race distinct from the agricultural pioneers, though generally their advance guard. Such a double exodus of man and beast left the plain a desert, green or blossoming indeed, but almost as forsaken as the Siberian obi, save for the prairie hen, sometimes startled from its lurking place in the rank grass, and their migratory season, pigeons high overhead on the wing, in dense multitudes eclipsing the day like a passing storm cloud, save these, there being no wide woods with their underwood, birds were strangely few.
Blank stillness would for hours reign unbroken on this prairie. It is the bed of a dried-up sea, said the companionless sailor, no geologist, to himself, musing at twilight upon the fixed undulations of that immense alluvial expanse bounded only by the horizon, and missing there the stir that, to alert eyes and ears, animates at all times the apparent solitudes of the deep.
But a scene quite at variance with one's antecedents may yet prove suggestive of them. Hooped round by a level rim, the prairie was to John Marr a reminder of ocean.
With some of his former shipmates, chums on certain cruises, he had contrived, prior to this last and more remote removal, to keep a little correspondence at odd intervals. But from tidings of anybody or any sort, he, in common with other settlers, was now cut off, quite cut off, except from such news as might be conveyed over the grassy billows by the last arrived prairie schooner, the vernacular term, in these parts and times, for the emigrant wagon, arched high over with sailcloth and voyaging across the vast Champagne. There was no reachable post office as yet, not even the rude little receptive box with lid and leather hinges set up at convenient intervals on a stout stake along some solitary greenway, affording a perch for birds, and which, later in the unintermitting advance of the frontier, would perhaps decay into a mossy monument, attesting yet another successive overleaped limit of civilized life. A life which in America can today hardly be said to have any western bound but the ocean that washes Asia. Throughout these plains, now in places overpopulous with towns, over opulent, sweeping plains, elsewhere fenced off in every direction into flourishing farms, pale townsmen and hale farmers alike, in part the descendants of the first Salish settlers, a region that half a century ago produced little for the sustenance of man, but today launching on its superabundant wheat harvest of the world, of this prairie, now everywhere intersected with wire and rail, hardly can it be said that in the period here written of, there was so much as a traceable road. To the long-distance traveler, the oak groves, wide apart and varying in compass and form, these, with recent settlements, yet more widely separate, offered some landmarks. But otherwise, he steered by the sun. In early midsummer, even going, but from one log encampment to the next, a journey it might be of hours, or a good part of a day, travel was much like navigation. In some more enriched depressions between the long green graduated swells, smooth as those of oceans becalmed, receiving and subduing to its own tranquility the voluminous surge raised by some far-off hurricane of days previous, here one would catch the first indication of advancing strangers, either in the distance as far sail at sea, or by the glistening white canvas of the wagons. The wagon itself, wading through the rank vegetation and hidden by it, or, failing that, when near to, in the ears of the team, peeking, if not above the tall tiger lilies, yet above the yet taller grass.
Luxuriant this wilderness, but to its denizen, a friend left behind anywhere in the world seemed not alone absent to sight, but an absentee from existence.
Though John Marr's shipmates could not all have departed life, yet as subjects of meditation, they were like phantoms of the dead. As the growing sense of his environment threw him more and more upon retrospective musings, these phantoms, next to those of his wife and child, became spiritual companions, losing something of their first indistinctness and putting on, at last, a dim semblance of mute life. And they were lit by that aureola circling over any object of the affections in the past for reunion with which an imaginative heart passionately yearns.
He invokes these visionary ones, striving, as it were, to get into verbal communion with them, or, under yet stronger illusion, reproaching them for their silence.
Since, as in the night's deck watch, ye show, why, lads, so silent here to me, your watchmate of times long ago.
Once for all the darkling sea, you your voices raised how clearly, striking in when tempest sung, hoisting up the storm sail cheerly. Life is storm, let storm you run.
Taking things as fated merely, childlike through the world ye spanned, nor holding unto life too dearly, ye who hold your lives in hand, skimmers who on ocean's fore, petrels were the larks and larks ashore.
Oh, not from memory lightly flung, forgot, like strains no more availing, the heart to music haughtier strung, nay, frequent near me, never staling. Whose good feeling kept ye young? Like tides that enter creek or stream, ye come, ye visit me, or seem swimming out from seas of faces, alien myriads memory traces, to enfold me in a dream.
I yearn as ye, but rafts that strain, parted shall they lock again. Twined we were, entwined then riven, ever to new embracements driven, shifting gulf weed of the main. And how if one here shift no more, lodged by the flinging surge ashore?
Nor less, as now, in eve's decline, your shadowy fellowship is mine. You float around me, form and feature, tattooings, earrings, love locks curled, barbarians of man's simpler nature, unworldly servers of the world, ye present all and dear to me, those shades or scouring China's sea.
Whither, whither, merchant sailors, whitherward now in roaring gales, competing still yet huntsman's whalers, in Leviathan's wake what boat prevails? And men of war men, where away? If now not dinned drum beats so to quarters on the wild of the midnight waters, foemen looming through the spray, do yet your gangway lanterns streaming. Vainly strive to pierce below when tilted from the slant plank gleaming, O brother, you see to darkness go.
But, gunmates lashed in shotted canvas, if where long watch below ye keep, never the shrill, all hands up hammocks, breaks the spell that charms your sleep, and summoning trumps might vainly call, and booming guns implore. A beat, a heartbeat musters all, one heartbeat at heartcore, it musters. But to clasp, retain, to see you at the halyard's main, to hear your chorus once again.
Good job, everybody. That was hard.
Look, the sir, sun is coming out.
Those are amazing sentences.
I know.
Wow. Oh my God. They're beautiful.
Yeah. It's nice to go back and look at 19th century literature every once in a while, isn't it?
Well, and it's so curious that it's 19th century literature that's looking back.
Yeah. Yes.
You know, so it's...
Hmm.
You know, looking back again. So it's looping.
Yeah.
Skipping like a rock.
So, yeah, why don't we I wanted to engage in a discussion about this, because I know reading it the first time, I've read it a few times now, so I've got a lot of ideas, but I'm curious to sort of hear what you were thinking about when you were reading it. Obviously, Helga, that was one of the first things I thought. This is just such beautiful writing. It's not something we're used to. We've sort of forgotten. We have sort of impoverished language in some ways today, right? In written. I think our spoken language is probably richer than I give it credit for, but I think written language, I don't know, sometimes I do feel this lacking too. So I like this communing with, as Mar is communing with the sailors of old, which I think is also somewhat of a metaphor for artists too. There is something going on here. Any other thoughts or impressions just on this first read?
Well, I'm reading Moby Dick right now too.
Oh.
Which I've been reading for a long time. It's really enjoyable to just take your sweet time with Moby Dick, because, like, basically what you were talking about, the cadence of each sentence, like, just the way that something can go on and on in thought and then come back around is, like, it's a different form of thinking than I do now. And so it's really nice to be. It takes a while, I think, to really begin to, like, follow the train of thought the way that it's being constructed.
What's fascinating is this edition that I found at the UBC Library also has a facsimile of the handwriting that Melville, when he wrote the short story. So you get to see how he crosses things out and draws arrows, and you just see the whole process of stitching together the narrative and the language, which, you know, we don't see anymore because we use digital products, right? And, I mean, we can see it if we use track changes in Word or something like that, but it's a very different process. So there's a kind of craft involved that we get to see at work.
I think there is an interest in that, like the Robert Walser's superscript or microscripts, but with the actual showing how he wrote it and his handwriting is almost illegible, but they published with every piece the actual handwritten manuscript.
Oh, great.
Similar with Emily Dickinson.
Yeah.
Because all her line breaks and her punctuation were potent. They were as much a part of what you were to experience in reading them. And so there's been a Susan Howe, particularly, an American poet, has kind of gone through her text to retrieve that which is kind of unspoken, but spoken in pauses and blanks and commas and dashes and things like that.
So the visual manifestation of her thinking. Yeah.
Also, I have seen in beautiful in cursive handwriting, I'm trying to figure out who I saw recently, and of letters that there were no editing, and I thought that this person, whoever it was, I think it might have been a writer or a visual artist, I don't know, had totally got into forethought so much that his beautiful handwriting is that it was all of one piece when he did it, sort of that he acculturated or made himself capable of writing a perfect script, like a letter like this, like in perfect handwriting, all complete, never edited at all. And that I find like even more amazing.
Was this a contemporary person? No.
Oh, no, this is a 19th century handwriting. The reason I remember this is because my father had like beautiful cursive handwriting, and my grandfather even more so, right? Because I still have documents with those things on them. I think that part's really impressive, how you can sort of write a whole page without making an error and then send it off.
Yeah.
So even if you're copying the one that you did previously, it's still sort of like, how did you do that?
Yeah. So I guess we thought about loss, nostalgia, definitely themes at work in John Marr's character and in the narrative that Melville constructs, right? It's quite sad. It's a sad story, is it not?
It is. It is. Well, the loss of his, I love the way he expresses that sentence. Ere long a fever, the bane of new settlements on teeming Rome, and whose sallow livery was to show itself after an interval in the complexions of too many of these people, carries off his young wife and infant child.
Yeah. So he,
in other words,
makes you,
they died.
Yes, but yes. He makes you kind of go through the duration of that sentence, right?
Completely.
You experience it. In a way, he prolongs the experience of that story. In a sentence. So on the sentence form.
And then in the next sentence he refers to the mound builders.
Yeah.
Of a race only conjecturable, and had left their pottery and bones and now one common clay and a strange terrace serpentine in form.
Sort of like a story of complete alienation.
Yeah.
Right? A complete alienation, and I don't know if, I mean, like, this is like sort of reading sort of the subtext, is that if he wasn't romanticizing the camaraderie on the ship.
Okay.
That, you know, that in memory sometimes we romanticize the past because all the, you know, the trials and tribulations you're having at the moment are over, they're gone. So that all that you remember is basically how well it went because you survived, right?
Yeah, it's interesting because when I was reading this at first I thought, yeah, obviously this guy's isolated. He's born an orphan, right? Motherless, nationless. He sails under diverse flags, loses the wife and child, and he misses his sailor chum. So
well, that's all he can conjure,
right? But in another way,
he's got the landscape that reminds him of the sea. Right.
Yes, but I'm also wondering if there's something else going on here, which, when I was talking earlier about fixity and time and idea, mm-hmm. even though he's lonely, he remembers very fondly these other mariners, right? And so, why is that? They're always in movement. Although they might feel alone, it's a temporary situation too, because you're always shifting, you're moving about. But, I mean, even in the beginning, the contrast that he has, like, he says at first that he's a sailmaker who moves from seaport to seaport and then becomes a rough bench cutter. I mean, the striking contrast in scale and imagery, right? The majesty of the sail to the low, pathetic, common characteristics of the bench. I mean, just think about what you can do. With one of them, you move multitudes over hemispheres. With the other one, you maybe give a few people a moment's rest. Not so comfortable either at that, you know? So just these contrasts that he makes up. So there's something about being connected in the world that allows for a kind of camaraderie. There's something about this movement in idea and in space, because he also, of course, characterizes the land, the inland people, if you will, as being maybe a bit ignorant, maybe a bit, I don't know, out of touch, a bit isolated themselves, right? So even though he's isolated, he feels on the sea, he's connected. When he's moving about, he feels a kind of connection. So there's something going on here that I find very, very interesting, particularly because this is the 19th century. This is when people are also moving on ships all over the place and industry's moving on ships all over the place. I actually found this one review of Moby Dick that said they read the whole story as actually Ahab was an industrial capitalist who put a factory on the sea and was so greedy. The whale was his lust and greed, this insatiable greed that he was condemning his crew to death for. That was one way of interpreting it. But I think, Corey, you're right. I think there's many ways of looking at it. I mean, this could very much be a love story in another sense, like you were saying.
But
you know,
also,
when I have a real cynical take on this.
Oh, okay.
I mean, go ahead.
Yeah.
Well, I was just going to say that maybe you should finish what you're going to say.
Well, I have sort of a cynical take on this. I think that he's sort of riffing off on the whole prairie seascape and schooner and all of that. And he's sort of being cynical himself as that this is not the sea. This is
right.
Not the vessels. These are not sailors' mates, right?
Right, so why is one exploration not okay, but the other one is?
What?
It seems to me like one exploration is okay, but the other one isn't, right? That I see that happening in the story.
But I think that Melville seems, I mean, admittedly this is the only third work, I mean, I've only read Moby Dick and Bartleby the Scrivener, but I suddenly am starting to notice this pattern where he's interested in these contradictions, right?
Yeah.
That, and you know, in the beginning of, and also in the kind of alienation of being on the land. So there's, you know, like the beginning of Moby Dick, he talks about wanting to knock people's hats off because he's so frustrated with sort of regular society that's the time he realizes he needs to get to sea. And Bartleby the Scrivener is all about alienation as well, right? And it's all about, and again, born out of Melville's experiences as a bureau, or like a file clerk, essentially, and you know, the tying it to the dead letter office and the you know, this kind of despair of relationships that is involved with discovering, you know, wedding rings that haven't, you know, arrived at their proper destination, and various other kinds of things. But he's kind of interested in these, it seems that he's also interested out of this sort of shift of, like, just because you're in this other place doesn't mean you're better off, and sometimes you're worse off. And again, I'm thinking in Moby Dick, there's the scene with, or the description of, I think it's Stubbs, who rises to the rank of officer, and suddenly his life is way worse off. Like, suddenly he's hungry, because he has all this protocol about being an officer, and he can only eat for a certain period of time, and he has to, you know, he has to follow all these rules, and suddenly he gets less sleep, he eats less, you know, he's in this like worse situation, and it seems like in a lot of these stories of Melville sort of alluding to this place, like, this is where you should feel social, or that you should feel happy, or at rest, but you're actually, it's actually out at sea, it's in the place where you're most in danger, most with the smallest group of people, that is actually where you're most comfortable. You know,
that so that's me. Where his queerness comes in. Mm-hmm. That's sort of his,
yeah, I think you're right, Jonathan. I think that's actually a really important part of his work, and is dealing with that paradox and contradiction, right? So he seems to be early on, as an artist or a writer, understanding, putting in paradox, writing it in and grappling with it, and rather than overlooking it and trying to make a neat story, he says, no, we need to contend with the complexity with which our lives are graced or disgraced with, you know, as it were. So I think this is something that I'm trying to also bring into my own life as a contemporary person, a contemporary artist, also looking at the context in which you live in. So this idea of commuting, which I think he's also trying to talk about amongst the ghostly sailors, is something I'm wondering, is that something that we can use as a learning aid, or some kind of way of figuring out what it is that we can do now ourselves? I mean, I feel, Jonathan and I, when we're talking about the beach talks, you know, one of the things I thought about was, what am I working on now? And so I've been thinking about institutions by artists, the conference that's coming up. And part of that is coming to terms with artists recognizing where they are in the world and what it is they want to do, and actually articulating themselves and their institutions at the same time. And so that's in the present. But I think there are other ways in which we can engage art forms and voices to help us through what I call sinking ship times. And I don't know, so this was really just an exercise of looking at someone who I think takes it on very, very cleverly, but also with complexity and with contradiction. But I'm curious because, you know, I have a few days, but I'm wondering if you're getting anything at all out of this that would be applicable to you today, as an artist or working in culture in some form. I mean, is this just pure isolation and sadness, or is there something else to be gleaned from it, whether or not Melville intended for you to see that?
Christina, you were talking... Oh, sorry.
No, go ahead.
No, yeah, you...
Well, for me, it seems very contemporary, actually.
Yeah.
And we did this event recently where Aaron Peck was reading excerpts and in relation to some works in the gallery, and He read something from Moby Dick in relation to a photograph by Dan Sinney, and it was just like this sort of perfect synthesis. And it, of course, it had to do with the sublime and image itself, and this kind of the complexity of how we see and work with lore and legend and, for you know, like all that we bring to perception too, which is what I see and hear a lot. It's like he's negotiating his own relationship to many things, and it's that kind of investment that to me seems like something that we all grapple with. It's sort of like, where are you, where do you stand, or where's your position as you are negotiating the world?
And negotiating with those who are absent.
Yeah, and that too. And so that's how it works for me, to think about this as something, yeah, like really, even one could apply it to digital realities, or it doesn't seem nostalgic. So. Okay. I mean, he deals with nostalgia too, and I think a lot of his writing is, he's aware of that, but as we should be more aware of the, you know, the seductiveness of nostalgia. So I don't know, I guess to me it seems pretty
okay.
Relevant.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think he's trying to give himself a kind of metaphorical structure for maintaining some kind of connections with other people, with history. And in that stanza that that I had the good fortune to read, you know, like tides that enter creek or stream, ye come, ye visit me. Or seen swimming out of seas of faces, alien myriads, memory traces to enfold me. He says, oh, not from memory lightly flung, forgot like strains no more availing the heart to music, haughtier stuff. Nay, frequent near me, never stale. So it's like about that he's celebrating the imagination.
Yeah.
And how that sustains him. You know.
Absolutely. And,
yeah.
I think also he's really making a case for art in this story to me.
Yeah.
I mean, he even actually literally says it a couple of times. The first one being on page 13. So in the second full paragraph, he says, this is the one where Robin had to read more familiarly. That's very hard to say. To consort, men of a practical turn must sympathetically converse and upon topics of real life. But for John Marr to say that, yes, he knows, in order to engage with his peers, he needs to talk about quote-unquote real life. But for him, this is something that is dissatisfying and actually something separate from art. That's kind of what he's, I think, implying here. But then he reinforces it on page 14, the bottom of that. Something was lacking. That something was geniality, the flower of life springing from sense of joy in it, more or less. This their lot could not give to these hardworking endurers of dispiriting malaria, men to whom a holiday never came, and they had too much of uprightness and no art at all, or desire to affect what they did not really feel. And on the one hand, I think he narrates these inlanders as, you know, maybe provincial, maybe ignorant, but on the other hand, I think he does feel sorry for them too. They never have a vacation. There is no art in what they do or what they live.
At a corn husking.
Yeah.
Their least grave of
right.
gatherings. It's like, whoa, fun.
Right, so, but there is a kind of, on the one hand, you sort of, is he judging them, like, harshly on the one hand? You know, you have to ask that. But on the other hand, he does also seem to have a real sympathy for them. So, anyway, I do think there is a case that he's making here for art, and an art of consequence, too, by the way. He says this later on page 15, at the very end, he says, this to John Marr seemed of a piece with the apathy of nature herself as envisaged to him, here on a prairie where none but the parish mound builders had as yet left a durable mark. So, okay, at the end of your life, one probably does think about, what's my legacy? What am I leaving behind?
But it's very interesting that it's on the same page in which he talks about art and no art. So I think there was this kind of punctuation for me throughout the text where I see him making a case for art. However, being someone who at the end of his life wasn't very much appreciated anymore, he might have also felt slighted. Might have been like, hey, you people, you forgot about me, my fellow artist. I mean, that's another way of looking at it.
What did he mean by art, do you think?
Well, I think he means by anything outside of the workaday life, no? But it's not. But he obviously saw art in the workaday life of the mariners, right? He gives this poem over to them, which I believe is like a sea shanty, or it's in that spirit. Something about that kind of engagement or communion, Robin?
I don't know. I guess I was thinking more sort of concretely about the characters. You're talking about art, the duality between the sea. In that second paragraph, and becoming the bench builder, and so that loss of craft, or that sort of like meandering out on sea. But the other situation is that like, in some respects, his art or that overall sort of artistic life or creative life that would have been the fraternity with the sailors and the being the sailmaker, creating something that would mobilize things. Brought him to this sort of colonial wasteland. What he's sort of seen is sort of like an artless, empty colonial wasteland. Because you were asking Corey about those two, the evaluation of those two levels of exploration. There seems to be, if there's a melancholy, is also that the art delivered him there.
Yeah, yeah.
And so the stakes in terms of like, it's not like the consequences aren't just simply that he's arrived where now you have these sort of homesteaders. They're tearing across, like working their way across, and this sort of vulgar version of a sailboat, which is this wagon.
Yeah, that's right. He does seem to make it seem like the wagon is a vulgar sailboat.
In that sense, so he sees his craft and his life being contorted. For this sort of landlocked life and the impacts of that, perhaps.
Yeah. But I find the most heartrending part of that story is when he gets shut down. Okay? When he tries to tell a story and
tries
saying,
to tell a story.
Oh, you better give it up. We don't, we just
we know
don't
nothing
get
of
it.
That
we,
here.
We just don't understand it. No.
Hasn't anyone ever said that to you about art?
Oh, every time I open my mouth. What are you talking about?
but see, it's interesting because listening or reading that part, I did think about those experiences.
Yeah.
You know, when you try to bring art into the conversation and it gets shut down, right?
Yeah.
Why does it get shut down? Because it's frightening or it's unintelligible or what? Anyway, I was definitely thinking about this while reading the story. And about communion or lack thereof or obstacles to communion.
I think nowadays, I think it's like when you bring art into a conversation, people have this feeling that it's going to be contentious, right? And that their discussion may become a little heated or something, you know, they're afraid of that, and especially I think in this sort of like outpost colonialism, that people just feel uncomfortable about having heated discussions.
Yeah, I don't know. I hesitate to read this through what I understand to be art. You know, it's more like image or his own sense of desire or something.
I probably would agree with you, Helga, on that. I think the sense of, like, in the particular way that he uses art seems to me like it's more of like a general art, as in like artifice versus nature.
Mm-hmm.
That these people would be closer to nature, or that he's sort of like, it seemed like more something about making a distinction between people who live in the country and people who live in the city, or and less specifically about like art as in like an aesthetic pursuit.
Oh, I don't necessarily, I mean, I think he is definitely making for me, a distinction between land and sea and art and real. There is something about that. And I don't necessarily mean an art with, like, the kind of art that we do, but I think there is this happening, for sure, that there's some kind of schema in which these things get contrasted. And there's something about... The thing that I'm not quite sure about, though, is with the mound people and nature, because in a way he's saying... I think he would say that those people are closer to nature, and yet they leave more of a mark in the mound.
He refers, though, to the apathy of nature.
The
herself,
apathy of nature, yeah.
As envisaged to him here on a prairie where none but the parish mound builders had left a durable mark.
Yeah.
So, where...
But see, that's interesting, right? Because you would think in... In general, people would say the mound builders are closer to nature, and yet they leave behind something, even though nature might be apathetic toward humans.
Well, maybe, you know, when you think about how art happens in times of surplus.
Yeah.
You know, and that if there were cultures that came before that, like the cultures up the coast and here, who in their isolation and in their times of plenty were able to make things and create the culture. It sounds to me that who he's imagining himself encountering anyway in this story are people who are impoverished at a very basic level.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think in a cultural way.
And well, yeah, in
too.
A survival way.
In a survival way, too.
You know,
yeah.
In art sense, we play a little bit too, right?
Yeah.
I think that's what they're saying. Like, there's nothing, there's, and this...
Corn husking?
I mean, corn husking, but that's, I mean, that's the great, I mean, Melville's very funny, right?
Yeah.
He's talking about this being their least
grave.
Is, yeah, that, and it's, it, which is a great put down, or
it
great
is a great
criticism, yeah. But, and that's, I think that's what I mean, like, no art at all, meaning no, like, no chance to be outside of your...
No leisure.
Actual daily. Daily
yeah.
You know,
yeah.
No embellishments. No.
Yeah. Okay, yeah, I think he might be feeling sorry for them.
Shanties?
I didn't come across any corn husky shanties, but I do have a few to share with you. So I brought three songs. Now, what is all that about? Well, in Moby Dick itself, Melville does publish one of the best-known shanties, but I didn't bring that one. I think also that this last poem, although it's not in the structure of a shanty, I can't help but think of it as being related. And so I just started reading about them, and they're fascinating. So apparently there are many different forms of shanties, and they occur at different times, but the kind that we are sort of familiar with, I would say, arises probably somewhere, I guess, in the mid-19th century. And it gets, and apparently they got used quite a bit on American merchant vessels. So sailing vessels that were merchant sailing vessels. And what I found fascinating, too, as I was looking into them, is that prior to, I guess, the American Civil War, there were a lot of sea shanties, per se. There might be sea chants to help with work, but the actual form of the shanty of singing comes out a little bit later. And apparently it takes a lot of inspiration from African-American work songs as well, because from the times of slavery on, there were many, many different forms of work songs that came out of African-American communities to help with the labor. So I've also brought one of those. Okay, so maybe we should play the CD. The first one, I have some lyrics in the back.
Are we going to sing?
If you want, go for it.
Is it in here already?
It's like... Sing all together.
Yeah.
All right, so the first one is from these singers called the Fo'c'sle Singers, which stands for Forecastle. And they were an American folk band. I didn't hear about them before. But apparently they found all these songs through BBC field recordings of Englishmen singing shanties. And so they re-performed them as folk musicians. And this song was recorded in 1959. And it's probably more like what we expect to hear when we think of sea shanty.
All on the bowl and onward we are going.
All on the bowl and the bowl
and all on the bowl and before she starts a rolling.
is interesting to me because it's by the American folk and blues musician Leadbelly. And what I love about this is he's singing a sea shanty that he rewrote the lyrics to. So I gave you the lyrics of what they would originally sound like in, you know, on a merchant vessel. But he rewrote the lyrics for his purposes as a folk and blues singer. But I love it because it's kind of like this idea of retranslation, right? From African-American work song, sea shanty, into American blues. So it's called Holloway Joe.
Just take a look at the cruise ship emerging from behind the...
they have a lot of art.
Yeah, no, it's like...
Oh. Are they shadowing the tankers?
Yeah.
Ready?
Yep.
Way, all the way, we'll haul away you. Way, all the way, we hope for better weather. Way, all the way, we'll haul away you. I kissed a little girl and her lips gonna quiver round. She says, way, haul away, we'll haul away, Joe. We're down in Mississippi when the boat was overflowing. The boy says, way, haul away, we will haul away, Joe. Way, haul away, we'll haul for better weather. Way, haul away, down in New Orleans, they had a big ship driving over to Mexico. Boy says, way, haul away, we'll haul away, Joe. Down in New Orleans, up Canal Street. Yeah, the boys crying, way, haul away, we'll haul away, Joe. Way, haul away, we'll haul for better weather. Way, haul away, we'll haul away, Joe.
Sea shanty boys, wait.
Way, haul away, we'll haul away, Joe. When the boys all get tight and some of them gonna give down. Way, haul away, haul away, Joe. Way, haul away, we'll haul for better weather. Way, haul away, we'll haul away, Joe.
Okay, that's it. And there's one more. So the last one, I just, you know, when you fall down the YouTube hole, you just can't get it. I just went on this crazy, crazy search. And the last place I stumbled were these field recordings that Alan Lomax had done. So he'd done so many of them, right? He's well known for it. But ones in particular that really struck me were the ones he found in the southern U.S., and they were performed by chain gangs, usually African-American men working and singing songs as they were on the chain gang. And so what you'll hear is a song from 1947, a recording from 1947, and you can hear the shovels and the pickaxes moving as they sing. So it's the last one.
Around my right side.
Thank you for coming.